This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 7 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today is the recap of our series on Simon Pegg, looking at all of the movies which he has written. And yeah, going back to the very beginning and then, you know, getting to the end and seeing what we think about his assignment to write Star Trek Beyond based on what he's written up until now. So, five movies.
Five different outcomes.
Going back to 2004, his first movie was Shaun of the Dead, which was co-written by Edgar Wright and directed by Edgar Wright, starred Simon Pegg, as all of Simon Pegg's movies do. And, yeah, you want to tell people what that one was about?
Zombies. It yes. was about it was about an underachiever who winds up having to grow up and mature very quickly during the unforeseen zombie apocalypse that at first is barely noticeable from daily life for him.
Yes, it starts off as sort of a romantic comedy and quickly becomes a zombie romantic comedy. Zom-rom-com, as they are, it's often referred to. But what did you think about this movie?
It's a clever movie. It's a well-paced, well-written movie. The dialogue's really good. The characters are fun. I don't think that there's a single character that, you know, I don't like or felt that the performance pushed it into, you know, the realm of necessity. You know, like there wasn't a character where it felt like, oh, if that person hadn't played it. Like every character felt right, felt necessary to move the plot along. I thought that the development of all of the characters was really good. It's got a surprisingly strong backbone for a, as you call it, Zom-rom-com.
Mm-hmm. It is very solid. It's a movie which I like more every time I watch it, I think. It really has sort of grown on me, and I think the reason for that is because it is really dense, you know. I mean, we've talked about that frequently throughout this series, about how there's a lot of stuff going on in it, and it's kind of very intricately constructed and all this stuff, and that's very admirable. And it's weird because as a Zom-rom-com, like all of those things are kind of dismissed by a lot of people. And, you know, you think of like highfalutin dramas, you know, or like huge, like epic blockbusters or something as being these intricate works of art. But here's a very sort of unassuming, tiny movie about zombies and love and zombies, and it is pretty sophisticated. It's very sophisticated.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really cool, and I think that that makes for one of the best movies that Pegg has written. Certainly, I would say it is the most noteworthy movie that he's written, like most critically acclaimed by far, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hell of a debut. Like, there's a reason people took notice of him.
Yeah, for sure. So that was followed up 3 years later with the second film in the Cornetto trilogy, which was Hot Fuzz, also co-written by Edgar Wright and directed by Edgar Wright, also starring Simon Pegg. And yeah, could you give us a synopsis of that one?
Parody of cop movies. Pegg plays a phenomenal super cop who's embarrassing everybody else on the force, and so they ship him off to a quiet little hamlet. So that he's not making everyone look bad. And it winds up backfiring because he uncovers a giant conspiracy that is inspired by Agatha Christie and The Wicker Man and, you know, all of those sort of classic things. And there's a James Bond, The Equalizer, and Belloc in it.
Yeah. Also inspired by Michael Bay, which is pretty great.
Oh, I mean, that's right. Yeah. And Michael Bay.
Any movie which is inspired by both Agatha Christie and Michael Bay, you got
it. And isn't it technically, because Point Break, I think you said this, Catherine Bigelow?
Point Break is Catherine Bigelow, with the screenplay by James Cameron, by the way.
So there, you know, there's a Catherine Bigelow. There's two Oscar winners you're referring to right there in the movie. So yep. Way to go, guys.
Yeah, yeah. Man, I just forgot that James Cameron wrote Point Break. I need to check out this remake. Point Break is not a good movie. I'm sorry. It's not. It tries.
Still have to see it.
It tries. And the one thing which I will take away, I will always think of this whenever I think of Point Break, is for years and years and years, there was this rumor going around that James Cameron ghost directed Point Break, because they were like, well, you know, it was his wife and, you know, it's really good and women don't know how to do action and whatever their reasoning was, which was ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
This was the rumor. And not to mention, it's like, what is, like, you think that Point Break is some sort of masterpiece that only James Cameron could make? And yeah. Like years later, James Cameron, like someone asked him about it. And he's like, that's absolutely ridiculous for numerous reasons. But anyone who knows anything about directing can obviously tell that I did not direct this movie. Because if you look at all of my movies, I use very short wide-angle lenses. And Point Break was shot almost exclusively with long telephoto lenses. So, duh. And I'm like, that totally sounds like something only James Cameron would ever notice. And yeah. Also, he's right. It was. You know, like Catherine Bigelow always uses long lenses, and he always uses short lenses. So now anytime I watch either one of their movies, all I can think about is how long the lenses are.
And yet, typical, normal, simple people like myself just look at it and say, that looks pretty.
Oh, well, no, from now on, you'll be looking to see how shallow the depth of field is in all of these shots. I guarantee it.
Yeah, no, actually, I'm replaying Strange Days in my brain right now.
It is, and it is. I mean, it's totally, yeah. And by the way, if you haven't seen Strange Days.
Well worth it.
Oh, my God. December 31st, just watch it. It's good. So yeah. Good. So completely. Good.
That, you know what? You're right. That's the perfect movie to watch on New Year's Eve.
That's the movie that I watatched that movie on December 31st, 1999. I was so scared to go out. I thought the world was going to end. I locked myself in the basement and I watched Strange Days, and it was awesome.
So you made the conscious decision that the last thing you were ever going to see was Strange Days if the Y2K thing worked?
Like, I didn't think that the world was going to end. I didn't think, like, all of a sudden, like, the, you know, the timer was going to go off and it's like, uh-oh, time for the world to end. I just thought that people would be going crazy, and I thought it was going to be like The Purge, you know? Like, people are just going to be running through the streets, you know, just insanity. Things would be on fire.
If that thought had even occurred to me, I would not have gone to Baltimore on that New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
That is the last place I'd go.
Yeah. I mean, I was super terrified, and I lived in, like, this little suburb, you know, but, and then, like, I'm watching the thing on CNN, and everyone's just like, isn't this the best? It's happy. Everyone's happy. It's like, oh, okay, I guess that's how it really works. I guess I've seen Strange Days too many times. But anyway, but yeah, watch Strange Days. And also watch Zero Dark Thirty, because that movie's amazing.
Oh, that movie's insane.
It's so
good.
That
is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, she's such a good director. Anyway.
She really is. She really is. And I would like to see her try her hand in a Star Wars. I think we've talked about this. The Star Wars movie.
Yeah, well, that'd be
one
great.
Of the side projects.
I'd like to see her do anything, really. But anyway, none of that has to do with Simon Pegg, aside from the fact
not at all.
Hot Fuzz references her movie Point Break, which you haven't seen and which I don't like. So there you go. moving on. I guess we should say, well, what did you? Oh, you just said what you thought of.
Yeah. Hot Fuzz. Well, yeah. It's more polished. It's well worth seeing. It's very funny. But the like the one thing to knock it on as compared to, say, Shaun of the Dead is the character arc isn't quite as satisfying. Like there's a real satisfaction with what happens with Sean by the end of the movie, as opposed to Hot Fuzz. But this is true to its, you know, inspiration material, that the main characters don't go through quite the same amount of change by the end of the film.
I mean, maybe that's what it is. You know, like Shaun of the Dead is like a character piece where the zombie apocalypse is kind of the setting for this character piece. Whereas with Hot Fuzz, it's more focused on sort of the genre than it is on the characters. And maybe that's where the difference lies, because I think it's better as genre parody than Shaun of the Dead is. But I think that Shaun of the Dead has a stronger script for in a traditional sense. So,
well, yeah, because Shaun of the Dead works even if you take the zombie stuff out.
Yeah.
Whereas Hot Fuzz only works as a parody.
Yeah. But yeah. I do like Hot Fuzz a lot. I do think it is a lot of fun to watch, even if it's probably technically not as good as Shaun of the Dead, especially from a writing standpoint.
Yeah.
So after Hot Fuzz, everyone's careers blew up. And they went off and they did a million and one things and, you know, took a little break from the Cornetto trilogy. And Simon Pegg, while on that break, signed on to, I think, probably first star, I'm guessing, in a movie for David Schwimmer called Run, Fat Boy, Run, which was based on a screenplay by Michael Ian Black, but then rewritten by Simon Pegg himself. Into the movie that exists today. He anglified it or whatever. And you want to give a synopsis of Run, Fat Boy, Run?
Guy runs from his wedding, and he's a ne'er-do-well and doesn't advance in life, gets a dead-end job. And then the mother of his child, who is his ex-fiancée, winds up falling in love with a character played by Hank Azaria, who's rich and intelligent and successful. Guy's really a jerk behind the scenes. Of course, she doesn't see it. And this motivates Simon Pegg's character to run in the not London Marathon, but the Nike River Run or something like that.
Yes, I think that's what it's called. The Nike River Run. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you think about that one?
What did you think about that one, Mike?
I liked it when I first saw it. I thought that it was kind of weak overall. I thought that it was, compared to Simon Pegg's other work, at least. But I thought as far as romantic comedies are concerned, it wasn't a bad one. It was fun, you know, whatever. So when I rewatched it, I was looking forward to it. You know, it was the type of thing where it never was something which I felt the need to revisit. And I probably never would have revisited it had it not been because of something like this. But I wasn't dreading it by any stretch of the imagination. But upon rewatch, what I found was it's not very good.
Yes.
It's not a monstrosity of, the proportions that we've seen in episodes past, but it is not a good movie. I think it's definitely the worst movie that Simon Pegg wrote. And I would say it's very sort of insignificant to his filmography. It feels like a work for hire, and it feels like he should be doing something better.
It's a mulligan.
Yeah.
I forgive him for it, but don't rent it. Don't watch it. We watched it for you. It's our kind holiday season gift to you.
Yes. I hope you appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, before getting back to the Cornetto trilogy, Simon Pegg did one movie. This one, I feel like it really did come from the heart, unlike Run, Fat Boy, Run. Maybe Run, Fat Boy, Run did come from the heart. I don't know. And that was Paul, which he co-wrote with his co-star in most of these movies, Nick Frost. It was directed by Greg Mottola, an American filmmaker, who has done such movies as Adventureland and Superbad, and such TV shows as Arrested Development and, well, really, who cares what else, because Arrested Development is, you know, the
exactly.
Tops. Yeah. So, would you like to give a synopsis of that?
Yeah, two guys go to San Diego Comic-Con, and they're British, and so they're taking a road trip, and they meet an alien who's trying to get back home, and he's a foul-mouthed E.T. portrayed with the voice of Seth Rogen.
Exactly.
And along the way, hijinks ensue, which apparently Mike finds very funny, but I kind of fell flat with me.
I love this movie. I love it so much. And I don't know why I've not really sung its praises as much as I should have been for, you know, however many years it's been since it came out. I believe it came out in 2011, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
Watching it now, which is only the third time I've seen it, really, really struck a chord with me. I don't know if it's just because it's an election year or what, but, you know, I'm...
I struggle to see how that has to do with anything, but okay.
Well, I mean, like we talked about before, it's very much a satire of America from a British perspective, you know? It's definitely, they're taking a road trip through America and along the way hitting all of the things which kind of make America great, in a sense. I really do think that's what they're doing. I mean, in addition to it being a sci-fi comedy, whatever.
They hit convenient stereotypes that are then caricatured. And maybe that's what didn't strike me as particularly funny is these characters that they run into along the way. There's nothing particularly original or fresh about them. They are stock stereotypes of how. I'm an exurbs boy. Not country boy, but exurbs boy. I grew up where, you know, there were big dusty places and not many shopping malls and stuff like that. 7-Eleven was, that didn't show up till I was much older. But the stereotypes that Paul pulls in are sort of how city folks see anybody that doesn't live in the city. They're those types of caricatures where it's like, oh, well, yes, I'm not somewhere that with a Starbucks, therefore they're all country bumpkins who most likely sleep with relatives. Like the caricatures are that easy. They're that simple. And that's why I would especially give the script negative points is because I know that Peg is better than that. I know that he's better than that.
That could be, I don't know. I guess my thinking is this is a very broad comedy in every way, you know? So having like over the top caricatures of these things is to me in keeping with the rest of the script. I mean, I would say that they are over the top caricatures of, you know, nerdy British tourists as well, you know? I mean, you know, it's told from their perspective. So maybe it's more, gentle ribbing than, you know, going after some of the other, you know, stuff which they tackle in this. But I guess I don't have a problem with that so much, you know.
I just think it's lazy. I've thought about it a lot since since we talked about it, and it's like that is really what bothers me about it is you could be absolutely right that it's in keeping with the motif of making a movie like this. And maybe that's just why I just don't like movies like this a lot, is because I think that the characters that they pull in are late. You know what? A road trip movie that isn't lazy about its stereotypes would be Vacation.
Okay.
That classic. Like they, you know, the evil, awful aunt and the fools that they meet along the way and that sort of thing, they don't feel just thrown up there. They feel like they were actually put together with a real comedic thrust. And that, you know, just for me, that would be the one that I would go back to as an example of the people you meet on the road are still funny and stereotypical, but there's nothing that's vaguely, you know, it just Paul just feels low effort It just does to me.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. I mean, perhaps it is low effort. I don't know. Whatever it was, it struck a chord with me. Maybe part of it is because of, I mean, like what we were talking about last week, where its characters, you know, even though they're, you know, a couple of British guys, are, you know, sort of very much, I guess you could say, proxies for me and my friends, in a sense, and that they're, you know, nerds who are doing extremely nerdy things. And it really does feel like that part of it is not necessarily lazy, in the sense that, you know, in the Big Bang Theory sense, you know, where like they've done their homework in those ways. And, you know, I mean, that's what I'm going to be most critical of, to be honest, you know.
But see, that's the one part of the movie that I grant you, like the beginning and the end when they're at San Diego Comic-Con, I think is really when the movie shines, because you're absolutely right. We know these people.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, like there are stereotypes in those moments too, but they're sort of the loving, like, yeah, okay. I've kind of seen this. Yeah. I get what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing. So
I guess that's true. I mean, the other overwhelming thing to me, which is certainly the reason why I would revisit it, you know, again and again, is because I do find it to be laugh out loud funny, which is something that I don't do. I don't laugh out loud at things. I really don't. Anytime that I laugh on this show, anytime like where you say something funny and I'm like, kind of like you just did now, that's me, you know, being polite.
Wait a minute.
No, I mean, it's true. Like that laugh that I did just now about me saying that thing, that was me being polite, you know?
Man,
I don't laugh.
This hurts, because every time I come off of the show, I'm like, you know what? I'm a pretty funny guy.
No. But see, I'm genuine. No, I'm genuine in my laughter. I'm just, it's like me saying, good job. But like, if you try to get me to laugh, like, I cannot laugh. I can very easily not laugh. Tell me a funny joke. Tell me a funny joke.
Nothing that I can say on a clean show.
You know, I mean, like that. I didn't have to do that, but that's my natural reaction, right?
There you go.
But like, I would never do that while watching a movie, you know, because, you know, Simon Pegg's not sitting there in front of me. You know, I might be sitting there watching Shaun of the Dead.
I get what you're saying.
This is hilarious, you know, but. If I'm just sitting there by myself, I'm going to be like, and you know, the audience couldn't hear that because it was a smile and a nod, you know,
but it was like, a very enthusiastic smile and a nod,
right? You know,
were I to describe it, I would say, if you walked by this gentleman making this expression, you'd say he's having a good time.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
But like when I was watching Paul, there were times, even though I was by myself, where I was like, ha 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 ha. You know?
Yeah. And that's, I'm not being critical. Like, I really think, if anything, comedy is definitely one of those things where it's got to hit your funny bone.
Yeah.
And I really think that comedy, even more than drama, like a dramatic movie, you and I can nitpick, but we can both sort of find the dramatic thread and both, you know, say, oh, well, I can relate to this and that sort of thing. But comedy, like you're talking about, like the big laugh out loud stuff. Like for me, like the end of Home Alone,
mm-hmm.
like I practically chased people out of the theater. I was laughing so hard.
Oh, yeah. I did love that too when I first saw it.
Well, okay. Well, all right. Then my whole example just like got torpedoed, because you also haven't seen Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. But basically what I'm saying is there are probably movies that I would guffaw at.
Mm-hmm.
Guffaw, I tell you. And you would look at me and you'd be like, what? What is wrong with you? You're psychotic. That's not funny.
No, I mean, yeah, that's the way it works. You know, I'm sure that's. I mean, I think that Mallrats is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I'm sure that you don't agree with that.
Oh no, I loved Kevin Smith's first three movies.
Okay, fine. Dogma. Then.
He didn't start stinking until Dogma.
Okay, Dogma then. Loved Dogma. Thought it was hilarious.
The longer cut of it was better. But yeah, you and I would diverge on Dogma.
Okay. All right.
Although Jason Lee, that guy just has to walk on screen. I think he's hysterical.
Oh, yeah. He's the best.
Yeah.
He's the best. But by the way, as long as we're on the subject of Jason Lee and Dogma and whatnot, Kevin Smith and whatnot, I've been rewatching this show Dinner for Five, or watching it for the first time. Have you ever seen this thing? John Favreau.
That's on YouTube now, right?
It is. Well, I mean, you know, it's on YouTube. Everything's on YouTube. It's not. Oh, it's not like it's like YouTube's. You know, it's just like someone took it and stuck it on YouTube. You know, but it's John Favreau. You know, and he gets like four random people to sit down and do like at a dinner at a fancy restaurant, and they just talk. You know,
okay.
And he gets cool combinations. And well, there was one episode. And this is like 2005. This is like right after episode 3 came out. And Kevin Smith was the guest host. And his four guests were Stan Lee, Jason Lee, Mark Hamill, and J.J. Abrams.
Oh, for Pete's sake. And this is the one where Hamill talks about how he thought his character should have gone dark. And everybody was like, that means he's Kylo Ren. That's the one.
Is that really what people were like, as if Mark Hamill had anything to do with that decision or whatever?
That specific conversation came back up.
Oh my God.
And people, and people ran with that, and they were like, this means that he's Kylo Ren. That definitely means that he's Kylo Ren. And like, I had the same reaction you're having. I was like, this conversation's old, and he's talking about something that happened in 1983 that has nothing to do with the script they wrote.
Exactly. But regardless of that, watch this episode with this conversation, because, you know, it being right after, you know, episode 3 came out, it's Mark Hamill and Kevin Smith talking about episode 3, and, you know, Kevin Smith basically saying, like, what would you do if they did an episode 7? And Mark Hamill's, like, saying, and then at one point, J.J. Abrams is like, what are you guys talking about?
They're like, oh, so funny.
It's crazy. And this is 10 years ago. You know,
I fully expect Kevin Smith now to go on tour, a speaking tour, mind you, and film it saying that he's responsible for episode 7.
You know what?
And got screwed out of it because somebody told him to put giant spiders in it.
You know what? I'm just saying. But no.
Now, that was a genuine laugh, Mike, just so you know. That's what it sounds like.
Okay, fair enough. And I'm being like overly dramatic with my not laughing, if you know.
I get you.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway.
I hate it when we fight, Mike. Let's talk about something happy.
All right. Let's talk about the world's end. Yeah. Let's do that. How about that?
All right.
So, what's the world's end?
The world's end is a pub.
Yes, it is.
The end of the, what is it, the Golden Mile? The Miracle Mile?
I think it's the Golden Mile.
Yeah, the Golden Mile. 13 pubs, 12 pubs, 12 pubs in one night. And Simon Pegg plays a guy whose life sort of peaked in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to get all of his old friends back together so that he can go. And he is fairly convinced that the one thing is, if he can complete this trip this one time, if he can get them all to the end, then his life will get back on track. And he'll figure out what direction he's supposed to be going in. And along the way, they find out that the entire town, nay, the majority of many towns in the world, have been taken over by space alien robots that are replacing people, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yes.
And that's not really a spoiler. You find that out pretty early on.
Yes, you do. And, you know, in similar fashion to Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, this is kind of a genre-bending parody of classic movies like The Stepford Wives and all that stuff, mm-hmm. Invasions of the Body Snatchers, like you were saying. And it very much sort of in keeping thematically with the other movies, both in terms of that, but also in terms of sort of the idea of becoming an adult, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what did you think about World's End?
You know what? I actually like it even more since we had our discussion about it, because I was struggling with the ending, and I think you put me on to sort of the interpretive angle that I'm still sort of like working out in my brain. But I gotta be honest, I am going to go back and I'm going to rewatch the entire Cornetto trilogy. But as it stands right now, I like The World's End best of the three, because I feel that it has a real wisdom to it, a real dramatic angle to it that gives it a weight that is just, it feels just a little bit deeper and a little bit more personal. I think it's possible that in World's End, there are certain aspects of some of the characters that really resonate with some of the older friendships of mine that went sideways through the years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's probably why I'm responding to it so strongly. But I love it. I think it's great. I loathe owning physical media, but I am actually considering buying the Cornetto trilogy because of The World's End.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it a bunch, too. I like it more now watching it for this series than I did when I first saw it, you know, when it came out. And, you know, I can't argue with the fact that it does seem like the most, you know, sophisticated, mature, you know, work in the trilogy. And I think that only makes sense. It should be, you know, in a lot of ways, if you look at the way that the trilogy arcs and everything. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's really tough because the movies, for being a trilogy and for having these similar themes and everything like that, and, you know, not the same characters or anything like that, but all the same creative people behind the screen, behind the scenes, they are very different from each other in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I have trouble differentiating them on a, you know, quality scale, because mm-hmm. they are all so different and offer such different things in a lot of ways.
Sure.
So I don't really know which one's my favorite. I'm going to say Shaun of the Dead, just because I think that that's probably the most logical one to pick, because it's probably the most logical of them. But is it the most fun to watch? Is it the thing that will resonate with me the most when I watch it? Probably not, you know? I would say most fun to watch might be Hot Fuzz, and most resonant might be, you know, World's End. So,
but I will say it is it's a testament to the strengths that Peg has, because you're right. The movies are different, but you can still tell it's the same creative force behind them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like there's a signature style, and of course directorially with Edgar Wright as well, naturally.
Yeah.
But even in terms of writing a script, like you can, you know, I don't want to draw a comparison or anything, but it is seriously like sitting down to a Mamet or a Tarantino screenplay. You can tell when they have written something.
Sure.
Or even stuff that Tarantino, like Ghost, wrote, like certain scenes on, was it Crimson Tide?
Yeah.
You're like, well, yeah, that's a Tarantino exchange right there. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I agree. And I guess, I mean, that kind of segues into our final, you know, piece here, which is, you know, comparing and contrasting and seeing what all five of these things together mean in terms of making up a career or a filmography mm-hmm. for Simon Pegg as a writer. So we've got Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, Run, Fatboy, Run, Paul, and The World's End. So what do you see? What do you see from that mix?
I see somebody that can, he can juggle as a screenwriter a lot of characters and have each one have a voice. Even though I didn't like Run, Fatboy, Run or Paul, each character in it had their own unique voice. And I think that that is very key to making a Star Trek movie work, is to make sure that no matter how many characters you have in there, they are each distinct and discernible from each other. Like, it never feels like somebody's up there just giving dialogue because you haven't seen that character in a couple of scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that Peg is going to be very good for managing multiple character arcs at the service of one big arc that goes from start to finish.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I look at them, I see, you know, thematic similarities more than anything else. And all of his movies really do seem to be about, I mean, I wouldn't say like coming of age, but in a sense, coming of age, or sort of like growing up in the adult sense, like coming of maturity. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like each one of his movies are sort of about these kind of like man-child characters who, you know, are finally getting a hold of their life and becoming, you know, the men that they should become, if that makes any sense. I know that sounds like very testosterone filled, and I don't mean to do that, but
well, he's a guy playing a guy, so it makes sense that you would say that he's on the journey of a guy, you know, sort of finding his way.
Yeah,
it makes sense.
And I mean, I like that. You know, I mean, those stories intrigue me. Maybe because that's what I'm doing or not doing. I don't know. You know.
Well, you know, it'll be very interesting because I found that his treatment of female characters, I think, is pretty decent too. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that I sort of knocked Into Darkness on was that I felt that Uhura's character took a significant step backwards in terms of maturity and necessity to the film in a lot of ways. And I think that Peg, based on how he has been able to have good female characters written in the movies, I think that he's going to be able to bring a strength back to her role or any other female role that's featured in the movie, you know, so that they don't feel just like Spock's girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, like it'll feel like this character has a meaning and a purpose of their own outside of any other situation they might be in.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what he does with Star Trek Beyond, because we know that he has sort of the geek cred, you know, which is something that you could say, you know, people either did or didn't have in all the Star Trek incarnations, you know. I mean, in these latest, you know, JJ verse movies, yeah, you had Roberto Orci, who was a super fan, you know, probably bigger than Simon Pegg. But in earlier incarnations, you had Nicholas Meyer, who had probably never seen Star Trek, really.
Yeah, probably.
Prior to this, yeah. So, you know, and it's like, well, who is that a good thing or bad thing, or is it a neutral thing? I don't know. To me, it's not necessarily good or bad, but different and interesting. And sure. I'm curious to see Simon Pegg, you know, what his take as someone who loves Star Trek is going to be on Star Trek, you know?
Yeah.
It's exciting. It's exciting. And, you know, I guess the thing that people should remember is that he's not the only one, you know, there is another. and that's Doug Young. And
yes,
he's a very different writer who writes very different things. And we're going to be taking a look at him in a couple weeks, so as not to, you know, think that, because I mean, that's, hey, Simon Pegg, in a sense, he's earned it, you know. Any time that anyone talks about the new Star Trek movie and the script, it's like, Simon Pegg's writing it. Oh yeah, and Doug Young, you know. But and you know, Simon Pegg has the stronger or the larger filmography, to be sure. He's definitely a higher profile name, certainly among geeks and among Star Trek fans, seeing as how he's one of the leads in the current incarnation of Star Trek. And yeah, I mean, he's also, you know, sort of like the guy who's written a bunch of stuff that people love. But Doug Young is there too, and he definitely deserves a look at as well. And we're going to be doing that in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
So, okay, before we... Oh, well, I mean, do you have any final thoughts on Simon Pegg? Or
he's great.
All right, cool.
There you go.
So before we wrap anything up here, I just wanted to mention one thing that happened just yesterday, I guess, from when we were recording this in regards to a Star Trek creator, and that is in relation to a movie which has been out for like 35 years, which has nothing to do with Star Trek. And that's Don Coscarelli's Phantasm. I've actually never seen this movie.
Oh, good. All right, then.
Not a big fan?
No. But I do know that Abrams would be of the age of people who would be a fan of Phantasm.
Okay.
It was a schlocky B horror movie that was, it created an impression. Like, it, if you saw it at the right age, it created an impression for you. And you were like, oh, this is great. I actually had a friend. I'm still friends with him. What a, had a friend. No, he's like, he's been with me through thick and thin since high school. I saw the movie because of him, because his older brother loved it. He's like, oh, you got to see Phantasm. And I remember watching it with my brother and both of us going, what the hell is this?
Yeah, I've had that experience before.
This movie is so bad, so incredibly bad, that it was, I actually went about a year ago to, we have a local horror host. He was big on late night TV in the local market here. Dick Dizel, who, Count Gore Duvall, great guy, seriously salt of the earth kind of guy, great shtick. Everybody loved watching him late at night. It was back in the days when he could get away with anything. Like, he almost set the set on fire one time, like live on television. And he was sort of like an early Mystery Science Theater 3000. He would show these awful horror movies late at night, and then he would have little bits intercut, you know, between the commercial breaks. And Phantasm, he would actually he actually blue screened himself in on a couple of scenes. And so a year ago, I had the pleasure of going to the AFI theater.
Wow. I've always wanted to go there.
He hosted an actual 35 millimeter print of Phantasm.
Yeah.
And basically broke it up, broke the evening up, and it was like an audience rip on the movie. And like, he showed stuff from like TV back in the days. Like, so this is what I did back then. But we all watched Phantasm. Like, we had a great laugh because the movie's bad, but everybody remembers it because the villain in it is the tall man. And it was Angus something or other. And his big thing was he would always find the kid and he would go, boy. And they had a silver ball that would race around and it would like stick you in the brain and like like dig all your blood out and kill you that way. So I've just described pretty much the entire movie for everyone, except for the whole alien planet angle. Sorry. But it's terrible.
Okay. All right. I guess here's my question for you. When you saw that 35 millimeter print.
Yeah.
How did it look? Was it starting,
banged up.
Starting to show
it was
its age?
Pretty darn banged up. It was the whole thing where like reels would start with like that sort of sepia washout.
Mm-hmm.
And like the cigarette burns were there. And, you know, it was like listening to a vinyl record, remembering all of the things that used to be part of a movie.
Yeah. And it was pretty banged up. And
yeah.
Because of it being pretty banged up, because of that sort of thing, and because J.J. Abrams probably is of that age of people who, you know, are fans of this movie.
Yeah.
He and Bad Robot have spearheaded a 4K restoration from the original negative of Phantasm.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty awesome. Even though I've never seen the movie, he's saying like, hey, this is a movie. It's a small movie, which doesn't get a lot of credit. You know, you're not going to get the Richard A. Harris, you know, Godfather restoration, you know, that sure. You know, it's not going to happen for something like Phantasm. But he's like, you know what? I got the resources. I can devote them to ensuring that generations to come will enjoy Phantasm.
They'll understand the terror of the tall man.
Yes. And, yeah. You know, I mean, he's talked in recent weeks about how the character in the upcoming film, Star Wars Episode VII, The Force Awakens, Captain Phasma, is a reference to Phantasm. And you talk about the silver ball and, you know, Captain
yep.
Phasma has the silver, you know, armor. And yeah. It's all, you know, it's all part of this thing. But hey, I mean, the only reason why I bring it up is because, you know, I think it's really cool that, you know, J.J. Abrams is doing this. You know, I like it. I mean, George Lucas has done this for things. You know, he's helped restore, you know, movies. I think some Kurosawa films and stuff like that. And you know, it's cool that, you know, Abrams is taking this philanthropic route and sticking up for the little guy and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I'll give him credit because even though it's a bad movie, it's a bad movie you enjoy for its badness.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're not angry at the end of it. You're like, that sucked. Yeah, but, you know, I'd watch it again to make fun of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost like Batman and Robin, where it's like the only reason you'll watch it is to tear it apart.
That movie, no. Nope, 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 nope.
You won't even go back to Batman and Robin for that reason?
I've watched that movie way too many times, and it's all been accidental except for the first time, you know?
Okay.
And I love Batman Forever, by the way, so take that as you will.
Shame on you. But the where I'll give him credit is he is in a position where even though it's not a movie that anybody's going to love, he's in a position to basically go back and preserve his childhood.
Yeah,
basically
he loves it, and right. That's all that really
and that's
matters.
All that matters.
And there are other people who are who do love it, you know, like your friend's brother and stuff, you know, and it's for them, you know. It's not for the people who are going to be watching the Oscars and who are going to go to the, you know, historic AFI Silver Theater to see, you know, the latest whatever, the King's Speech or whatnot. It's for the people who are going to the midnight shows and, you know, they should be able to have decent looking prints too. And that's pretty cool.
You know what? I do agree with you on that. Scorsese had Vertigo.
Yep.
And Abrams has Phantasm.
Yep. There you go.
What does that say?
I don't know. All right. Well, you know, we're finishing up on Simon Pegg. We've talked about how all of our episodes for this season, this final season, are going to be about Star Trek Beyond creators, and that's still true next week. But next week is also going to be a return to a series which we did a long time ago, back with like episode 92, where we were looking at the work of a Star Trek director. His name is J.J. Abrams. We looked at all of his movies. Mm-hmm. It was like a 4-part series, and he's got a new movie coming out today. Today. Everyone who's listening to this has already seen the movie, so we can just spoil it all. We haven't seen it yet, but
not as of this recording, but we will have seen it by the time this is out, right?
Captain Phasma is Luke's dad. There you go. Sorry, spoilers.
Kylo Ren is a Jar Jar clone. Who saw that coming?
I don't know. Anyway, that movie is Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. And next week, as our little Christmas present to you, we will be discussing Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, the new J.J. Abrams movie.
Yes.
Yeah. So look for that. Friday. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Simon Pegg's career this week, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Usually Mike and I are like,
what's going on? Our heads are just spinning like, what? I don't understand what's going on, you know? And, like, you know, when I listen to that, I'm like, are we, like, you know, bad?
The orb.
He requested, you know, a Bajoran officer to serve with him on purpose. You know, he understands. You make this their own. We can't.
I'm glad he did it on purpose. I could see him, like, accidentally requesting a Bajoran officer. Oh, man, I checked the wrong box on the form. Damn.
The Ready Room.
Actually, I think at this point, Vulcan Love Slave was probably just a short story, right? It hadn't been turned into a full-blown
That's right. It's not a full-blown novel at that point. Yeah.
It's just fanfic. It's just fanfic.
Yeah, just fanfic. Right.
Just on the internet. People started writing after first contact there in Montana.
To the journey! It's very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not. Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
So we're closing in on the World Series is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, the Sox were able to win the World Series in, you know, 12 games. So we're no White Sox, but we're like the Cubs or something. Oh, no, wait. They didn't win the World Series. Never mind.
The 602 Club.
To speak back to the lightsaber overall, I mean, it was practical reasons that they switched it to green. But I've always loved the fact that Luke had that green saber, even when I was a kid. Like, it's really cool. It's an immediate visual signal, you know, even outside of the outfit that he's wearing, that he's a different kind of person than even we saw in the previous film. And I really like that.
Literary Treks.
The pinnacle of episodes that we've ever done on that was probably when we had Tristan from To the Journey on to talk about some Voyager comics. And we ended up, that show was named Tuvok's Remedial School for Badasses or something of that nature. So, I mean, yeah, these old comics can just be very, very fun.
Meta Treks.
I looked it up, and ornare is the Latin word for to adorn.
That's fascinating.
So I looked up brekka, and it turns out the same spelling, B-R-E-K-K-A, is Old Norse for slope or hillside.
And that, listeners, is something you will only get right here on MetaTreks.
Better living through etymology.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. One way that you can help us out on the network is by buying some of our stuff. If you go to trek.fm/store, that'll take you to our Trek FM store on Redbubble, where you can look at all of the t-shirts and magnets and stickers and iPhone cases and everything else that we have available for you. I'm still pushing really hard for Trek FM, the Citizen Kane of podcasts. with the a version of Max's Citizen Kane ship sled. If you want that, let us know.
Yes.
Let Aaron know. Let's make this happen. Because I want that for myself.
That would be awesome.
It would be. So yeah, just go to trek.fm/store and you can find a link to it there. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find the network on Twitter at trekfm. You can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Or you can go to the Babel Conference, which is on Facebook. Just type in the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek.fm, Trek.fm, and click on the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, by the time this drops, I will be back out of my self-imposed exclusion from things like Twitter. So you can find me at Kessel Junkie, pretty much anywhere, actually. And then you can find me on a podcast that drops weekly called Wars with Nerds that I co-host with my buddy Craig. And this same week, we will be having a Star Wars-focused episode where he is going to be asking me esoteric and weird questions about Star Wars, where we postulate things that have nothing to do with The Force Awakens but might have always gotten under your skin.
Can't wait to hear that. It'll be fun. You can find me Let's see. Nope, can't find me on Trek FM anymore doing Standard Orbit. Sorry.
Boo. Well, you know what? You got. You know what? I want to say. I want to have a slight, you know, a little eulogy for your run on Standard Orbit. You guys were great as hosts of that show, and you finished so strong that it is. It's something else. I encourage, if you have not taken the time to listen to Standard Orbit before now, at least go back over the last several episodes and visit what Mike and Drew have done, because it was a real slam bang way for you guys to go out.
Well, thanks. We tried, you know, and it was the type of thing where we were like, hey, let's really end this strong, you know, let's go out, you know, yeah, like you're saying, with a bang, and get as many sort of cool people as we can to come in and just talk about crazy stuff. And I think that people who listen to this show would like it because it was very sort of creator oriented in a lot of ways. We had Mike Johnson and Sarah Gaidos who do the write and edit the comic book, that takes place in the JJ verse, talking about their process, the process of adaptation and that sort of thing. And we had Mark Cushman on talking about the time during the Phase 2 era, and Ben Robinson, who was on this show, talking about Maurice Hurley, talking about the Phase 2 era. So there is a lot of like good stuff there, a lot of sort of crossover with what we're doing on this show. So, you know, check it out. If you want to find out in particular what was going on in between, in the dark times, the real dark times of Star Trek, in between the original series and the motion picture. So check it out for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. You can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com doing Commentary Trackstar Babies. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, or you can find the show on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone, please support our sponsor who helps us bring Commentary, Trek Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. John, I listened to a book based on your recommendation.
Which was?
Smuggler's Run.
Oh, yes.
A Star Wars adventure with Han Solo and Chewbacca.
Yes.
And you guys, I know, on the 602 Club were talking about how great it was.
Yes.
What's wrong with you people?
What is wrong with you? How dare you lead up like that?
Look. Here's the thing.
Shame on you.
Here's the thing. It was okay. Right? I mean, but really, like, what did it do? I don't understand.
It's better than okay. Better than okay. It established a really interesting situation with Han and Chewie. It spoke. The characters were so right. It was somebody who got the characters. The creation of Alicia Beck was something special.
Yeah. I have a feeling that she's going to pop up. Well, she already, like, at least was mentioned.
She popped up in the Shattered Empire,
which was written comics. by Greg Rucka too.
Yeah, a reference to her, I should say. She didn't personally show up, but a reference to her.
Yeah.
Could she wind up being Captain Phasma?
Maybe. I can't see that.
Maybe she could.
I don't know. By the time people are listening, we'll never know because Captain Phasma is actually
the tall man from Phantom. Oh, God. Spoilers.
Spoilers. Okay. You know, I don't know. It was just, I've been reading a lot of these Star Wars books, and some of them have been really good, and some of them have been mediocre, and some of them have been bad. And this one was just kind of like, I don't understand what's going on here. I'm not like I don't understand it, but like I don't understand why it's going on here. What's the point? I don't know.
Well, all of these things are supposed to have clues and hints that tie into.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And I guess I did
like. Of course,
like
I suppose a clue and a hint are sort of the same thing.
I guess I did like the epilogue where it was like, oh, okay, so this is where Han and Chewie are now. That's interesting. You know?
Yeah. But, well, and the thing is, I don't want to spoil it, but yeah, the framing device of the old man in the bar telling the story about the owners of the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting.
It is pretty interesting. And I do have to say that while I didn't enjoy this book, I'm about to start listening once again on Audible to Weapon of a Jedi.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess we'll find out if that whether or not that's true or whether or not you're leading me astray once again.
No, I never lie. I never lie. I'm like the Landrew computer.
Okay. All right.
I'm incapable of lying.
Fair enough. Fair enough. But yeah, I mean, regardless of that, you know, I got these. Though the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I got these on Audible.
Yeah.
And
the performances are good.
The performances are good. I feel like Mark Thompson is an old friend now.
There you go.
And he's very good with the voices and whatnot. It's a good presentation, and I would recommend them. I've got the Weapon of a Jedi. I'm gonna get the whatever Princess Leia's is.
And Moving Target.
Moving Target. There you go. Yeah. And I'm gonna listen to them. You know, and hopefully, you know, in the next couple of days, so that I'll be all ready in time for Star Wars Episode 7.
Well, I have something else for you to listen to. To get ready for episode 7.
Okay, I don't know if I have the time, but what is it?
Battlefront, Twilight Company, Star Wars.
No, see, that is going to be the next thing. That's what I'm going to do after I'm finished with these books.
There you go. Written by Alexander Freed and narrated by Jonathan Davis. Mm. This unabridged audiobook. The description is a companion novel inspired by the hotly anticipated video game Star Wars Battlefront. This action-packed adventure follows a squad of soldiers caught in the trenches of the ultimate galactic war between good and evil.
Yes, I'm looking forward to this book, too, because I don't have a PS4. I've been putting off buying one because you can't watch 3D movies on a PS4, which is ridiculous. So I've been putting off buying one, and this...
3D movies is a criteria for you?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I very specific, like when I had to get a new TV, I'm like, it has to be 3D, has to use the same glasses that are in theaters so I can use my Tron Legacy Oakleys. And
well, I saw the picture of your Tron Legacy Oakleys, and I tip my hat to you.
Jealous, right? You're jealous?
Well, how could I not be?
I love my Tron Legacy Oakleys. I wear them for everything. When I watch Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, I'll be wearing my Tron Legacy Oakleys. But no, yeah, because I love 3D. And I have it, yeah. But you have to, like the PS3 can play it, 3D movies. Mm. The PS4 cannot. What's up with that? It's ridiculous.
I haven't bought a new game system because I think of how many diapers it can buy. And I go, I need the diapers more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the PS3 is mainly just because it's a really good Blu-ray player, you know. And also because I need something. I play MLB 16, the show, while I'm editing this show. As part of my process. So
I see.
Anyway, but because of that, I can't play Battlefront. So now I'm going to get this book for free on Audible.
Yeah.
So that I can experience Battlefront without playing it. And,
yes.
You know, you can too, because as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. Okay, here's a crazy thought. The next time we speak,
yes,
we will have both seen a new Star Wars movie.
Yes.
That's insane.
It is crazy. It's weird, man.
It's awesome.
It's weird.
It's awesome.
I feel a bit like Michael Corleone in the horrendous Godfather Part 3.
I like Godfather Part 3.
Of course you do. But the line I think of is... Every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
Yeah, they absolutely do. They absolutely
do. Well played,
do.
Disney.
Yes.
Well played.
Yes, for sure. I'm excited. So excited that next week, that's what we're going to be talking about.
Yes.
We're going to be talking about J.J. Abrams' latest directorial effort, Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
Let's find out how a Star Trek director does.
Yeah.